Ham. Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Minnesota Corn Growers, dedicated to bringing you a healthy, safe, and abundant food supply day after day, year after year, on the web at mncorn.org.
6 minutes past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Centerpiece of Governor Jesse Ventura's budget plan is apparently in serious trouble at the Minnesota legislature. The governor, you'll recall, has proposed broadening the state sales tax to a wide variety of goods and services to better reflect Minnesota's changing economy. In exchange, income tax rates would be reduced and the full cost of basic K-12 education would be shifted to the state, thus reducing local property taxes. But yesterday, five of Minnesota's major businesses said the sales tax extension would cost them tens of millions of dollars each and could force them to stop expanding in Minnesota. Northwest Airlines, for its part, said the tax change was draconian. Two key Republican leaders in the Minnesota House, meanwhile, now say the sales tax plan is dead. House Speaker Steve Swigum and Tax Committee Chair Ron Abrams say there's virtually no support for the governor's plan, and they say it's time for the governor's staff to come up with an alternative approach to tax relief and tax reform. Well, Governor Ventura has come by our studios today to talk about his tax plan, his plans for education funding, his campaign finance reform plan, whatever you'd like to talk about. So if you have a question for the governor, give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Governor, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm just fine. Is there going to be an alternate plan here, or are you going to stick to what
I stick to mine. Isn't that a great way to pass the buck? They haven't even come up with their plan A yet, and now they're asking me to pull them out and come up with a new plan that they can respond to. Well, I'm not going to fall for that. I'm taking all the heat right now. You know, all of it's focused on me. Well, in a short time, the heat's going to get switched to the legislature because now it's their turn. So I'm going to sit back. I'm happy with my plan. It's a balanced budget that goes to the year 2005. It's fiscally responsible, and I'm staying with it because I believe in the long run I'll be judged 10 years from now. They will have to expand the sales tax to services at some point in time. You know, I find it very interesting that these Fortune 500 companies are complaining about my tax plan when for the last 10 years they've been complaining Minnesota's property and income taxes are too high and hurt the business climate in Minnesota. So I took that under advisement and I'm reducing both. And, you know, now I guess the 500 companies are like, you know, our education system. No matter how much you try to help them, it's not good enough. So now, you know, I guess these Fortune 500 companies prefer the high income tax and they prefer the high property taxes.
If the legislature doesn't approve the sales tax part of your overall plan, does that mean then that the property tax reform proposal and the income tax cut, are they dead? Because it looks like you need the money from the sales tax to pay for the
It'll be very difficult. And that's why the ball's in their court now. It's not in my court. You know, on the Republican side with Mr. Swigum and Mr. Abrams, their major focus is income tax cuts. Well, they're going to have a big problem because, as you know, we have a bicameral system, correct? That means they've got to go into conference committee with the Senate, which is controlled by the Democratic Party, while the Democratic Party's not big on income tax cuts. So they're going to have to get in there and hash it out and bang it out, and I'm going to sit back and watch. Mm-hmm. And let's see what comes out of the legislature now, and let's see what they come up with. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sticking with my budget. I'm not changing. When they ask me to come up with a plan B, I guess they're asking me to do their job for them.
Have you given any thought to perhaps broadening the sales tax, but not to all of the goods and services that you know?
Well, you know, that's interesting, Gary. What about the services now that are being burned? What about the people out there who cut down trees? They get taxed, yet if you plant a tree, you don't get taxed. If you get a haircut for your dog, that's taxed. If you board a dog, that's taxed. But if you board a horse, it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, you're asking me to pick winners and losers, and I won't do that. I believe that we should broaden it fairly across the board so that everyone is equal in their taxation rather than sitting back and picking because you have a stronger lobby out here that for one particular service than you do for another one. So, no, I'm staying with mine. It's in the legislature's hand now. Let's see what they come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if they can come to an agreement over there. And if they can't, I got news for them. There'll be no special session. They've already been in session for 2 months. And what have they accomplished? Well, they're trying to ban pop. They're trying to ban tattoos for kids under 18, even with parental permission. They're trying to ban me from holding down a second job. That's what they've been focused on, banning things for the first 2 months. Ban, ban, ban. Well, I'm a believer in freedom. I believe in freedom of choice, freedom that we should make our own decisions. And what scares me a great deal is this perception that we have now, and what we're living under, is that are we that dependent upon government today? Has government become the most important things in our lives, that we dare not hurt the government, we dare not question the government, and we're giving up, we're supporting government, this feeling out there, more than individual rights and freedoms?
Mm-hmm.
It's government now. Government is the most important entity out there.
Now, I need to, before we get to callers here, I need to ask you about the education debate.
Let me add something, though.
All
did
right.
Did you read this week's Wall Street Journal on Monday?
No, I didn't.
You better. There's a great story on it about that. Here's a few quotes. Dan Bucks, executive director, multi-state tax commission in the Wall Street Journal, 3501, quote, anything of importance in state finance this year is going to be touched on in Minnesota. This was a story on what I'm trying to do. The Wall Street Journal gets it. Here's from the same story. Mr. Ventura's plan to broaden the sales tax, adds Harley Duncan, executive director of the Federation of Tax Administrators, meets most precepts for sound tax policy you'd find in textbooks, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently Mr. Abrams and them don't agree with these people at the Wall Street Journal.
Education funding, Lord knows there's been lots of debate about that so far. The other day here, you seemed to hint that you'd pretty much had it with the critics, and that you might, when all is said and done, back a voucher plan.
No, I never said I would back one, but I'm certainly, there's no accountability right now in our K-12 education system. You go out and ask, we had kids over there protesting for smaller class sizes. Well, someone should have told that youngster that I allocated hundreds of millions of dollars last year for smaller class sizes. Where did it go? That's the question to ask. Where is it going? Where is the money being spent out there on K-12? Because nobody seems to come up with answers. They won't answer me, and I'm the governor. Nobody comes up with answers on where the money's going. And the other thing that amazes me is you've got school districts out there that know they're going to get, say, a 9.8% increase in funding, and then they'll negotiate contracts that give out 11.5% in wages. So they're negotiating more than what they have. So what's the alternative then? Then they come back and say, well, we've got to cut programs now, because they didn't have courage enough to stand up during contract negotiations. How would that be if I did that at the state? If I said, well, we're going to give out more money in our contract negotiations than what we have coming in, than the revenue we have coming in. Well, in turn, then you got to raise taxes. So there's decisions that have to be made, and very critical ones, by the legislature. Do they want to cut taxes, or do they want to just fund everything? We had $8 billion in funding requests, Gary. And how quickly education forgot my last budget, huh? I gave them $1.3 billion in new money, the last budget that continues on, and now I'm the devil? I'm this horrible person? I gave them the biggest budget increase they had seen in over a decade. Now I'm simply asking for accountability, but apparently they don't want to give me that. And what else bothers me is when Senator Wellstone stands out there and criticizes my budget, when the federal government, this problem is, a great deal of this problem is based upon the fact that the federal government 20 to 25 years ago mandated special ed, and they agreed in their mandate to pay 40% of the cost of that. They've never gone above 11% right now. I think they're going to go up to 14, but prior to that, they've never gone over 11. Well, we as the states have had to pick up that unfunded mandate that all of our federal officials, it's been the number one issue of the national governors for 3 years in a row that I've gone out there, and all we hear from our elected officials in Washington is, oh yes, we agree with you. Oh yes, we're wrong. We should fund the whole thing. But do they do it? No. Senator Wellstone's had 10 years to get this job done, and he's failed. They have yet to fund their 40% that they, and what is that doing out on the street level? It's causing a huge battle between special ed parents and non-special ed parents, because in order to fund all the special ed programs, they then have to cut the programs for the non-special ed. Why? Because of the failed policy of our federal government out there, of which I guess the senator and those people want to point a finger at me.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, though, you haven't shifted your position on school vouchers.
No, I have not. Not as of yet. But I'm starting, as many people do, I'm starting to question our public education system now, because it just seems to me that there's no hard choices being made out there. There's no accountability out there whatsoever. And it's just, you know, if you don't give us our money, we'll bus in school children to stand outside the Capitol with signs. That was real interesting, too, wasn't it? My daughter's a sophomore in high school. She went to class that Monday. Now, they tried to say in the paper that this was a field trip. Well, how does a field trip get signs and stuff? They make signs for a field trip to the Capitol?
Mm-hmm. But clearly, I mean, it's certainly within the rights and probably good for society, democracy as a whole, to have a good, vigorous debate.
Here. Absolutely. That's why I've won already, Gary.
But
what disturbed me was the fact that we had teachers out there that should have been in class teaching, and we had students out there that should have been in class learning, and instead they're out protesting for money.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to some listener questions for Governor.
But debate is great. Hey, I've already won. I've taken sacred cows and brought them out into the open, and they're now being discussed.
Let's get to some listener questions for Governor Ventura. And, first caller is from Rochester. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Governor.
Hi, Gary.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about nursing homes and nursing home staffing. Everybody agrees that nursing homes are facing a huge staffing crisis, and they're turning people away who need care just because they don't have enough staff. We nursing homes need to attract and retain staff. We can't do it with what the state pays us. You know, our group health insurance took almost a 30% jump last year. Our heating bills for this winter have almost doubled. You know, how can we meet these obligations and bring our salaries up to a level where good people are encouraged to do this, you know, this vital work?
I got to look into that more heavily. I got to ask you a question. When my father suffered a stroke and went into a nursing home, he paid $3,000 a month and was triple bunked.
Yeah.
So that meant there was $9,000 a month coming in on payments to that particular nursing home. $9,000 a month. You could get a room at the Whitney for that price.
You know, there are all sorts of ways to decrease costs to nursing homes, not the least of which are to decrease some of the federal and state regulatory burdens on nursing homes.
Oh, I agree. I agree that I will support that fully to get rid of those regulatory.
But
please answer my question.
Yeah.
How is it that my father was paying $3,000 a month and was triple bunked? There were three people in that room, so that one room was bringing in an income of $9,000 a month. Which, if you multiply that out, that comes out to how much a year for one room?
Well, that's great. If it costs $10,000 a month to care for those three people, then that $9,000 a month you can't make up that.
Yeah,
that
that's true. Then why did the first lady and I walk in there at times and find my father didn't even have a blanket on and was laying in bed shivering?
You know, I don't know about your specific circumstances. I just know we have people who, nursing assistants who give their hearts and souls.
I understand that. And I think it's a business that needs to be looked at and needs to be put under great scrutiny of what's going on out there in the nursing home businesses today. I agree with you.
Is there money in your budget to bump up the pay of workers at the nursing homes?
Yes, there is. There's a COLA increase. Yes, there is in my budget.
Kind of a minimal deal?
Yeah,
or?
Pretty well. Yeah, you're right. You know, again, it's a case of we have to look at how much money there is and the priorities, and the legislature has every right to change those priorities. The ball's in their court now. Let's see them do their job. Let's see what comes out of the legislature. And then back to me.
Steve, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Governor.
Yes, Steve.
I run a small business. I have 6 employees, and I pay sales tax on the service I provide. I collect sales tax. And it's so complicated, and I'm responsible for it, and I call down there, I get a different answer every time I call them as to what's what, and I have to admit, I really think it's a great idea to expand it to everything and lower it a bit. It's a great idea.
Thank you.
And I think you're doing a great job. I think you got to stick to your guns. I think you're basically, you know, goring some sacred calves here, and I think it needs to be done, and I think it's...
Let me ask you the question. How do you feel about your service industry being taxed when other service industries are not taxed? Do you feel that's fair?
Yeah, I don't really mind that, except that it's so complicated to figure out who's got to pay me tax and who doesn't, because there's some people who pay, some people who don't. The whole thing is so complicated that I can hardly figure out what I'm supposed to do. Yeah. And yet I'm responsible for it, you know. Yep. So I'd rather see it expanded and simplified, and just everybody pays or everybody doesn't pay, and let it go at that.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to do. I appreciate it.
I think you're doing a great job. The other thing is, I drive by the university all the time. It's a forest of construction cranes. I mean, how can they possibly say that they're not getting enough money down there? They're on a building boom like never before, and I just can't imagine how much money that, you know, they're going to need to make that work. It's just there's too much money flowing there from our state budget.
Let me give you an example now of other Big Ten universities and what other governors have offered. I've offered ours an over 4% increase. The University of Wisconsin, and they wanted 18.4% is what the University of Minnesota requested, an 18.4% increase. The University of Wisconsin wanted over 7% increase. The governor there offered him 2.7. John Engler, the governor of Michigan, which has Michigan and Michigan State, has offered a 2.0% increase. Again, mine is over 4. The governor of Indiana, which has Purdue and Indiana University of the Big Ten, offered zero increase, zero. And even the governor Taft of the Ohio State, as it's called, the Ohio State, I believe 2.6% increase. Mine is well over a point and a half higher there, too. So when you start looking at other Big Ten universities and what other governors have offered in their budgets, I would like to know how they justify asking for an 18.4% permanent increase.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an opportunity to sit down privately with Mark Udoff at the university, Maury Anderson at Minsky, and talk this through a little bit? Because they claim that they have made substantial reallocations of money over the years to target money to the good programs like you suggested, and so on and so forth. And they said at this point they really have gotten it down to the nubbin, and that the additional money really is necessary.
18.4% and Minsky 22.some%? That's quite a bit. That's over one-fifth an increase in budget for Minsky and almost a fifth increase in budget for the U.
Mm-hmm.
Their needs are that high? You know what else is interesting? I met with all the deans of the private colleges, you know, like Carleton, St. Olaf, and all the private schools, and they told me that the average income of their student family income is less than that of the student that goes to the U. It's very interesting when you start digging into what happens and how the whole system works and all that. Like I said, that the average income out at those private colleges is less, and you're forgetting the fact that they're not bringing into play that I've allocated $34 million when I went out and talked to students. I listened to them, and they asked me, why does the institution get the aid money and not us? Why are we asked to vie to the, you know, and compete with the institution to get the money? Why not give the money directly to the student and let the institution compete for that student? Well, I listened, and we allocated $34 million in student aid to students directly to make sure that then the higher ed institution has to compete for that student. I think that's good. I think that type of competition is good.
Back to the caller, first comment he made endorsing the sales tax plan. Now, the big business folks yesterday, at least some of them, suggested that this is going to be, if you do in fact broaden the sales, it can be so expensive for them that they're going to have to expand elsewhere.
Well, then certainly they have the option to continue to pay our high income taxes or our high property taxes, which they've been complaining about for 10 years. is that they get it both ways? Is that what they're asking? Do they want it both ways? We can't do, you know, you got to make choices. And all I heard from them was property and income taxes for 10 years. Now, all of a sudden, an expansion of the sales tax? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not going to get passed on to their customers? They're going to foot the bill for it?
Are you concerned, though, that that they are, in fact, not crying wolf, that if it does pass, that they essentially will have to start moving more operations out of the state?
Well, why would I be worried about it passing when Mr. Svigum and Mr. Abrams said it's dead in the water? Well, then let's see what Mr. Svigum and Mr. Abrams come up with.
Joel, your question for the governor?
Good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Joel.
I wanted to say that I do admire you, sir, for bringing these subjects to up to the surface so that we can talk about them.
Exactly.
I agree with some of your tax and budget proposals. I disagree with others, and others I want to listen to the debate on.
Sure.
However, I think you should get a thicker skin and let it roll off a little bit. There are a lot of criticism. I know you get it from whether it's the news media or other politicians or people. I think you ought to get a little thicker skin. You would be a much more interesting and probably effective politician if you did.
Well, what am I doing wrong? I come in here and Gary asks me tough questions, attempt to answer them. The news media ask me tough questions, I attempt to answer them. And having thick skin means you clam up and go silent?
No, it's not so much that, but be more open to compromise.
Well, I am. I've said to the legislature, it's in your court. Go for it. Now let's see what you come up with. They're already coming back and telling me I need a plan B when they don't even have a plan A yet.
Well, yeah. Okay.
And you know, again, I'm just, if you know, the media doesn't want me to talk to them, then they shouldn't ask me questions because I'm going to attempt to sell what I believe in. And I feel very strongly about it. I appreciate your criticism, though, Dave, and I'll try to do better with it. But I think I have thicker skin than you think I do.
Okay.
I really do. You know, I
guess you've just never proved it to me.
Why? Because I respond?
Governor, I did want to say that, you know, I didn't vote for you last time, but I would consider it this time. And that
well, we don't know if I'm running again either. Dave, I don't know if I'm going to run again.
Yeah, no, I know.
Okay,
I know.
Thanks. Have a good one.
You're just thinking about it in the next year.
Yep.
Anyway, thanks for talking.
All right, appreciate it.
Thanks, Joel. Let's get one more question on here before we break for news headlines. Henry, that would be your question.
Yeah, hi, Governor.
Hi, Henry.
I appreciate you taking on these issues as well, and I don't disagree with you on special education costs. But as an example of kind of a realistic situation, my son is a first grader, and he recently was told that the school district would not be able to fund his reading programs anymore because of your budget.
Because of my budget.
Because of your budget. And I was just, obviously I don't think this is your intent, but if this is the reality, what do you think you can do about it?
Well, the thing is, what we've got to ask is why can't they? They funded it last year. I gave them a $1.3 billion increase my last budget. That's permanent money. That's not one-time money. And for all those people out there that are saying we should take the current budget surplus and apply it to education, that's a recipe for disaster because you're talking about one-time money for a continuing expense that you'll have to deal with then a year later again. The point being is, how come these were provided last year and they can't be provided this year? It's simple, because a lot of your school districts have negotiated contracts higher than what they have money coming in, so then they turn around to the district and they say, well, we're short of money now, so we've got to cut classes because they don't have courage enough to stand up in collective bargaining agreements. And so then they blame it to the state and say the state should. Do you know that spending on K through 12 education in the last decade across the board has gone up 100.7% in one decade, and yet they can't make ends meet? They're cutting classes. Something is wrong, and we need to find out what is wrong out there.
In the short run, Governor, what is your recipe, though, your response to a caller like Henry who says, well, you know, we get your position on this. We hear the school people, and meanwhile,
well,
as that debate goes on, meanwhile, it looks like some kids are going to get squeezed in the middle.
I think
here.
It's pretty sad when the kids are used as the bargaining chip.
But what?
Let me ask this then. Let me throw out another thing. Right now, in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school district, it's costing us $10,000 roughly per pupil. And yet, Creighton Durham Hall, a very elite private school, it's only $6,000. They don't get public money. Ascension Grade School in Minneapolis charges, I think, about $1,000 or $2,000 a year to go there. And why is it that the private schools are able to meet the needs and teach what they teach at a much lower price than what the public schools are able to do it for? What's going on?
Do you have some advice, though, for parents who are concerned that their kid is going to get squeezed here in the middle of this big debate over how much is enough for public education?
Well, my advice is be a concerned parent, be involved in your children's education, and I think that your child will succeed. I know that's kind of a vague answer, but the point is, where do we begin the debate on this? Am I to just fork out all the money and let the status quo continue? I mean, I don't see any great scores coming out of our public schools these days. They're starting to improve, but the scores in many of our public schools today are abominable. What's going on? Why is it that way? Now, I'll agree, in many inner-city schools, you're dealing with a migration of people coming in and children coming in that aren't fluent in the English language, and they have to deal with that. There's questions that need to be asked out there, and I'm simply bringing it to the forefront and making sure that they're now going to get asked.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour of midday, and we'll get to more of your questions for the governor in just a couple of minutes.
Legislative coverage on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Flaherty & Hood, a professional association representing government and business on state public policy issues.
This week, Congress plans to vote on a proposed repeal of rules to make America's office and factories easier on workers. Under current law, employers are required to redesign workstations and equipment to make them worker-friendly. Opponents say the rules cost too much and infringe upon states' rights. I'm Juan Williams, the health and safety of America's workers. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins at 1 o'clock here on Minnesota Public Radio. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Good morning, Gary. Incoming Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says talks with the Palestinians would begin only after the quiet will reign. Sharon is poised to take the helm after an expected approval of his unity government by lawmakers today. Islamic militants are threatening terroristic attacks. House Democrats are accusing Republicans of rolling back worker safety and insulting American workers. Democrats claim Republicans are rushing to protect their business special interests at the expense of American families. Democrats are backing Clinton administration rules aimed at reducing repetitive motion injuries in the workplace. The Republican-controlled House is to vote late today on a GOP effort to kill those rules. Yesterday, the Senate voted to do away with the regulations, which business groups call too extreme and costly. Bush administration officials say the rules are vague and cumbersome. House Republicans are predicting quick approval of the centerpiece in President Bush's tax cut plan. They're defending a decision to vote tomorrow on the measure to cut income tax rates. House Majority Leader Dick Armey insists this would provide an immediate boost to workers. He and other Republicans claim that 6 weeks after the measure is signed into law, Americans would start seeing less tax withheld from their paychecks. Democrats are attacking House Republicans for moving too quickly. House Democratic Leader Dick Gephardt calls it irresponsible to pass tax cuts without first passing a budget. In regional news, House and Senate lawmakers have introduced bills to include Minnesota in the streamlined sales tax project. Governor Ventura supports the plan, which aims to get all states to agree on how to classify taxable items. It also wants to put a system in place to capture internet sales taxes. A University of Tennessee study says Minnesota stands to lose $220 million in 2003 from e-commerce sales. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for mostly cloudy skies statewide. There's a chance of light snow in the north and east today, highs ranging from 28 to 35 degrees. At this hour, Duluth reports some light snow, a temperature of 29. It's cloudy in Rochester and 24. And in the Twin Cities, some clouds with a temperature of 28 degrees. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thank you, Greta. It is 25 minutes now before noon, midday, coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour, Governor Jesse Ventura. Before we move on to our next caller, Governor, we were talking a little bit off the air. Why is it that you and the education folks don't sit down in a room and say, now how much do we actually need to provide a good quality public education, then everybody'd be working off the same page.
I'd love that to happen. Let's, you know, right now I'll put the challenge out there. Bring in the educators. We'll sit down in a room. We'll bring the media into the room, and I'll give them that simple question. How much will it take, and where are you going to get it from? Because let's remember something, Gary. My proposal gives double-digit property tax relief. We've got a problem out there with elderly people who have paid taxes their whole lives. They're on fixed incomes now, so their ability to earn money has virtually pretty well come to an end to earn more money, yet their property taxes are rising at a rate that's driving them out of their homes. Now, do we want to sacrifice them and get them? And then where do they end up? In these care centers that the first caller talked about? Is that where the elderly end up then, when they can no longer afford to pay the property taxes and live in their homes? You know, these are the hard decisions that have got to be made now by the legislature. They're going to allocate all this money to all these places. And, you know, another interesting point is people are really on President Bush right now, because he wants to give us back this tax cut that they claim is far too high. Well, of a projected surplus, he's only giving us back 20 cents on the dollar. That means they're going to spend 80 cents on the dollar and they're complaining. What, do they believe they should get 90 cents on the dollar and we get a dime back? Where does that all end? And that boils down to that question I brought up when I came on your show. Is government the most important thing in America today, or is it people and freedom?
But, you know, on that projection, the budget projections, that was one of your big points and has been right along. I remember when you were first elected, people were saying, give it all back, give it all back. And you were always arguing, well, I am, but all I'm going to prove here is money that's actually in the bank.
Well, you have to hold the same true for spending then. You can't just go ahead and spend projections either. The shoe fits both feet.
So you'd be happy with... in this case, the president's budget or tax cut proposal, as long as spending didn't increase.
Exactly.
Okay.
But that isn't going to happen, because you got people out there that want to spend over 80% of the projected surplus and give you back 20. I guess they want us to only get a dime back, and they'll spend 90% of it on the government.
Beatrice, your question for the governor?
Hello. I'm really happy about your attitude of making the people accountable to, for the things that they spend. And my mother worked in the schools, and she said that the principals and the administration were horrible and so forth, and that was a long time ago. And even recently, my experience up here in Duluth was that I felt discriminated against as being an older person, and I had to drop out of school. And they have all these different offices or whatever in the colleges, all these different positions, but none of these people are doing anything. They just have people going around in circles to please them.
Okay.
And the vice president told me to drop a class in order to go around in circles and do the work that they were supposed to do.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Beatrice.
Well, you know, that's Beatrice's opinion, you know, and her practical or life experience of what she experienced out there. And I can't deny it or confirm it, only she can. She knows what happened to her.
Mm-hmm. Leanna, your question, please.
Hi, Governor.
Hi,
I just want to tell you that I appreciate you being available to talk, and that I like that you're willing to investigate issues. I really like that, as you've been talking about it, and that you're open to change. If you see something different, I just really think that's great. But my question is, or not really a question, just a statement, is that I really wish that we could get some more support for our seniors in the long-term care facilities. You know, like your instance with your dad not having a blanket. You know, it's because there's not enough people there to take care of all the needs that these people have.
But how can my dad be paying $3,000 a month and be triple bunked with two other elderly gentlemen also paying $3,000 a month?
Well,
that's $9,000 a month.
Sure, but how do you pay just $13,000 a month for a heating bill for a small facility? I mean, that's what was hit with our facility. That you know, we have
How many rooms? If you've got 20 rooms at $9,000 a
sure.
room,
but we don't have any more. We don't have any more big multiple rooms. Those were gotten rid of. People just don't want those kinds of rooms anymore, and they're down to two bedrooms or even single rooms. And the thing is that, you know, sure,
and
we
the
got,
price
we got,
hasn't
you know,
gone,
the rate increases for the nursing staff and our employees, which that was great. But how about for the actual facility to keep it going? See, I think that more than anything, that this is what's going to happen for our senior women, that they stay home and they've taken care of their kids, they've raised their kids, then their husbands get ill because usually they pass away earlier than the women. They take care of their husbands and they're trying to make ends meet and they're scrimping and saving like my friend across the street. I mean, she's taking care of her ill husband. When he dies, what is she going to have left? She's going to have raised property taxes, most likely. She's not going to be able to stay in her home. And when she gets sick, that's where she's going to be. And she's going to have to get rid of all of her personal
Can I ask you a hard question?
What?
Where are her children that she raised?
Well, unfortunately, her children live out of state.
Ah, but would there be the possibility that they would feel strong enough to bring my... You know what I did with what happened after the experience my father had in the nursing home? When my mother got old, she's gone now too, I took her into my home.
Well, see,
and
I did
it myself.
Right.
So
and
my
that's
point
what we
is
do with my mom.
Well,
but
my point
going
is self-responsibility.
There's going to be a point where I can't do that with my mom. My mom's blind. She's falling all the time. I cannot bathe her by myself.
It'll be a lot cheaper to bring
able to eat by herself.
Well, it'll be a lot cheaper to bring someone into your own home than to send her off into a nursing home.
But how about people who don't have family? I mean, it's her nursing home over here by me. There are women that have never been married. They're single women. They have no children. They have no husbands. They have nothing.
Yeah, there's certainly, and they're the people that we should be looking at. The ones that do have families, families should step forward and start taking care of their own families. And that way there'll be more left over than for those that don't. You can bring up a situation to me that certainly I don't have an answer for. That can be done. Personal situations, but I have to look at the broader picture of the whole thing and what's going on. And again, it's a dependency on government. We're getting so dependent that the government, it's up to the government to take care of us.
Mm-hmm. Do you
and if you do that, then be prepared for, you know, why do people then claim that we pay too much in taxes? If the government's going to take care of us, then we have to be prepared to pay 50-60% of our income if we're going to have the government taking care of us, because the government doesn't work cheap and they don't work for free. So therefore, then why are people complaining about high taxes? That's all I heard about is we pay too much taxes in Minnesota. They're too high. We're in the top echelon across the nation. So I step in, I try to lower those taxes, and now everyone's complaining the reverse to me, saying, well, oh no, government should be taking care of all of us. Well, if you're going to have government take care of all of us, then be prepared to pay over 50% of your income to the government so they can do that.
Governor, there's a school of thought, as you well know, that says that, in fact, you know, we talk about the budget surplus and returning money to the taxpayers, so on and so forth. There is a school of thought that says, well, really, we don't have a surplus because so many of these programs have been underfunded over the years. Transportation comes to mind, the highway system and the like. What do you think about that argument?
Those are priorities that the legislature can make. The ball is, again, is in their court. I've submitted my budget. You know, let's remember something. They build statues and monuments for people that spend your money.
Mm-hmm.
They build nothing for people that watch and guard your checkbook and are prudent with your money. So I don't expect to get a statue or a monument. And my final argument is this. Let me fire this out to everyone that's sitting out there. My first 2 years in office, permanent Minnesota government growth, permanent government rose 13%. Did your personal family income rise that much? Now, I am not going to, on my watch government grow 25% permanently under my 4 years, because that's the rate at which it's growing. And I tell everybody out there, take a look at your own budget and ask yourself, has my personal income grown 25% over the last 4 years? Because that all these people that are wanting this money and are advocating we spend all this money and spend like I did my first budget at 13%, if I duplicate that, that means it's a 26% permanent government growth in 4 years. How do you pay for that without paying 50-60% of your income in taxes? You can't.
Now, you said the ball is in the legislature's court at this point. You've laid out your priorities, your spending plans, and so on and so forth. If they don't, if the legislature, that is, kind of goes its own way, comes up with quite a different set of priorities, maybe scales back the tax cuts quite a bit and so on and so forth.
Think the Republicans will do that?
Well, I don't know, but if they did, would you veto those plans, or kind of go with whatever the legislature wants?
No,
or?
Again, that's a hypothetical, Gary, that I'm unprepared to answer right now. I've got to see what it is. You can give me all these hypotheticals, and I'm not going to sit here and box myself in a corner and say, yes, I will, no, I won't. Let's see what they come up with. My problem is Representative Abrams said, well, I hope the governor has a plan B. No, I don't. I have a plan A. It's there. Let's see your plan A before you come to me and ask for a plan B. Do your job. Now it's in your court, legislature. Do your jobs. Let's see where your priorities are. Let's see where your spending and your tax cuts fit into the equation. When they're done, it'll come back to me. I'll look at it if I can live with it and it's agreeable. And if it doesn't raise permanent government growth to 25% over 4 years, because who ultimately gets blamed for that? Me. It'll always come back, well, look at Governor Venter. Look at Governor Carlson. Government grew from, I think, a $14 billion budget up to $23 billion on his watch. And that's conservative? I'm not sure. But, I'm not going to criticize whatever he did was in his best interest and what he felt to do. But by the same token, I'm going to do what I feel is best. And after a 13% permanent growth in government my first 2 years, I am not going to sit back and say government's going to grow 25% on my watch when that is faster growth than the average family income. That's a recipe for disaster. Or, like I said, then be prepared to pay 50 to 60% of your salary to the government and let the government take care of you. You know, they kind of did that in the Soviet Union, didn't they, for a number of years. Government took care of you. You worked for the government, and everything you made goes to the government, and then the government provides to you. Well, if that's the road we're heading down right now, is having the government provide everything for us rather than we as individuals providing for ourselves and taking care of our own needs.
Is that then? Could that be said to be your highest priority? Obviously, you have a lot of things you're interested in getting done. But when all is said and done, is that your highest priority at this point?
Holding down
the rate of the growth?
Growth is permanent. I made two promises when I ran for office. My first promise was to give back all budget surpluses, which I've done. My second promise, and those are real budget surpluses, not windfall profit from a court case like tobacco, and not projected surpluses. This is in the bank. June 30th of this year, there will be an amount of money, depending on how much they want to spend. You already see they want to spend that surplus. They want to take that money and spend it. But June 30th, whatever's left over in the bank, I will give that money back to the people. And let me say this for all of you advocates out there that feel you want the surplus spent on your pet projects. We've set up the bill of the budget return that you can return that money to the state. When you get your check in the mail, you can designate, I want this to go for transportation. I want this to go to the University of Minnesota. I want this to go through K-12. So every one of you out there, when you get a surplus check, you have the individual right to send that back to the government. How well do you think that's going to do, Gary? I tried it on stadiums, and we only raised $85,000, and I contributed $1,000 myself to it. You know, but isn't that democracy at its finest? We're going to give the money to the people, and the people can then determine if they want it for their personal use or if they want to send it to the U or send it to transportation. They're free to do that, and we will have the account set up for it. That's the way the bill is out there.
Del, your question for the governor?
Hi, Governor. First of all,
Hi, Del.
Oh, hi, I think you're doing an excellent job. Some heat over some of the issues regarding with owning a cabin and such. And this, my call, it regards the DNR rule in the 70 on the 50-foot setback. The counties, I have a cabin in Stearns County, has it set back to 100 feet, and some lakes at 75. But at any rate, for all the people in the state of Minnesota that have a cabin that is less than that 50 feet or does not meet the county's required setback, insurance companies, if you sustain more than 50% in damage and cannot rebuild it, insurance company will not pay the 100% cost of the loss. So if I sustain 60% damage to my cabin right now.
Damage at what? What damaged your cabin?
From fire, wind.
So can you boil your question down to one sentence here, Dale?
All right. I think that this law needs to be looked at, that if everyone has their property up to code, they ought to be able to rebuild it and not take a loss.
Or you should be grandfathered if the code changed after your cabin was built.
Right. It changed long before my cabin
right.
was built.
Right. Well, long after, I mean, not before. I mean, if they change the law after your cabin was built, then yours should be grandfathered into whatever those new changes are. I wasn't aware of this, Dell. I'll be honest with you. It's never come up on the screen to me at all, but so noted. We'll look into it.
All right. Thanks, Dell. Appreciate it. Governor, a couple quick questions, interesting policy issues that have come up before we wrap up here. Senator Dick Day wants to block the Transportation Department from doing any work on this crosstown deal until 494 is expanded. Would you support that effort?
Well, again, I'll have to look at it, and I'd have to meet with Commissioner Tinklenburg and look at what our experts say and the people that work within my department, and if that priority is deemed more important, then we'll give it its due course. Congressman Ramstead brought that to my attention, too, and said that the expansion of 494 should be done on the west side prior to fixing the crosstown. But I suppose everyone that drives and comes up through that crosstown would have a difference of opinion. So, again, it's a matter of setting priorities of what you think is the most important thing to do first and down the line. But certainly it's been brought to our attention, and again, so noted.
Mm-hmm. Health Department has come up with a regulation which would essentially require virtually all, except the smallest bars and restaurants, and office buildings for that matter, to install either new ventilation systems ban smoking altogether in their facilities. Are you going to support that?
I'll have to look into it. Again, I've been looking at budget issues, and you're pulling out some smaller issues that I really haven't time to focus on, and you're the first one that's asked that question of me. So rather than, again, box mm-hmm. myself in the corner and give you an answer off the top of my head, I don't think it's very prudent for me to do that until I know all the details of why it's moved forward, what the problem is, and what the complaints have been on it.
Stadium is back. Stadium efforts are back again. Now, I understand your position, and I think everybody knows your position on that, except I want to ask you this. There's more talk that perhaps the state could come up with an interest-free loan for a new ballpark, a la what they did with the XL Energy Center. Now, would that meet your
Well, let's remember test? First, the XL Center didn't come interest-free. You ended up getting $1 billion bonding bill because they had to pass out the pork. The way they got all the legislators on board, see, bonding bills have traditionally held at about $500 million, except the year of the XL Center. There's a big blip on the screen. They had to go over $1 billion. What had to happen? They had to pass out the pork. They had to give enough legislators enough pork to take home to their districts to get them on board to vote for this. So it ended up costing us $500 million in additional bonding. So let's be clear about that, what the real price was for that. That's so given, it's water under the bridge, it's over. As far as interest-free loans, my belief is this, Gary. When's the last time you got one? Can you walk out to a car dealer and purchase a car and say, well, I really love this car, and I really want, and I'll take your loan, but I don't want to pay any interest on it?
So that idea isn't going to pass the Ventura test.
Well, to me, why should certain people get the benefits and other people not get them? You know, interest-free loans, I've never heard of those things out in the free marketplace. When they can show me out in the free market private sector that interest-free loans are the norm, well, then I'll start considering it.
Governor, thanks for coming in
today. Thank you, Gary. It's always a pleasure.
Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, our guest this first hour of Midday. By the way, don't go away. Next hour, we'll continue our discussion of the governor's legislative proposals, and we'd like to have you join that conversation. That's over the noon hour here on Midday.
Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 7th of March, 2001. It's the birthday of the Norwegian poet Rolf Jacobsen, born in Oslo in 1907, considered the first truly modern Norwegian poet. He was a socialist before World War II, but then grew disenchanted with leftist politics, and during World War II signed editorials in newspapers supporting the German occupation of Norway. The extent of his collaboration with the Nazis is still debated, and his supporters make the point that he never informed on anyone, never joined in the cult of the Führer, never embraced the racist elements of Nazism. But nevertheless, after the war, Rolf Jacobsen was convicted of treason and sentenced to 3.5 years at hard labor. After his release, he settled in a town north of Oslo, worked as a bookseller for 10 years, converted to Catholicism at the age of 43, and continued to write on into old age. 12 collections in all, including The Silence Afterwards, Secret Life, Fireflies, as his reputation gradually recovered. It's the birthday of the composer Maurice Ravel, born in Cibourg in southwestern France, 1875. He had a private income that allowed him the luxury of working slowly and steadily and turning out one polished composition a year. It's the birthday of the Dutch painter Piet Mondrian, his original name Peter Cornelis Mondrian, born in Amersfoort, Holland in 1872. He began painting representational pictures, became steadily more abstract, moved to Paris at the age of 40, and adopted a cubist style for a few years. And then, when he moved to New York in 1940, replaced his rather austere black-and-white style with colored bands broken by colored rectangles. It's the birthday of the plant breeder Luther Burbank, born in Lancaster, Massachusetts in 1849, grew up on a farm. He was influenced by the writing of Darwin, the study of evolution, and developed the Burbank potato, moved to Santa Rosa, California, where he established his famous greenhouse and farm, and developed over 800 strains and varieties of plants, plums and prunes and berries, and 50 varieties of lilies. And it was on this day in 1838 the coloratura soprano Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, made her Stockholm debut in Der Freischütz, the opera by Carl Maria von Weber, at the age of 18. Here's a poem for today by Edward Lucy Smith, entitled The Lesson. Your father's gone, my bald headmaster said. His shiny dome and brown tobacco jar splintered at once in tears. It wasn't grief. I cried for knowledge, which was bitterer than any grief. For there and then I knew that grief has uses, that a father dead could bind the bully's fist a week or two. And then I cried for shame, then for relief. I was a month past 10 when I learnt this. I still remember how the noise was stilled in school assembly when my grief came in. Some goldfish in a bowl quietly sculled around their shining prison on its shelf. They were indifferent. All the other eyes were turned towards me. Somewhere in myself, pride, like a goldfish, flashed a sudden fin. A poem, The Lesson, by Edward Lucy Smith, from A Tropical Childhood and Other Poems. Used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Research by Mert Simmers. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.